This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find out more about us at sevillepodcast.com. On Friday, April 17, 2009, former Governor of Virginia Jim Gilmore shared his views on The New Liberty with members, alumni, and guests of the Jefferson Society.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the hall, probationaries, my pleasure to be back again, once again, at the Jefferson Society. Back again. I am delighted to be here. I can't tell you how many years ago it was that I was a member of the hall, but I came here from high school and went to university and then joined the Jefferson Society. I still remember at the end of the first year, I was looking for something to do, and I didn't quite know what to do, and The resident assistant over there, the resident agent, is that what they call you? Said, you ought to go to the Jefferson Society. They meet every Friday night at 7:29. They roll a keg in the back. They all get drunk and yell at each other all night. And I thought, that's the place for me. So over I went and went out for a probationary membership and was accepted and made it one of the two really primary things that I did at the University of Virginia. I can still remember being seated in that chair right there the night that Walker Chandler was here in the hall. Does anybody remember Walker Chandler? Walker Chandler ran for president of the university in the late 60s, and he was on the Anarchist Party, and his slogan was, "Power grows from the barrel of a gun." He was elected, of course, to be president of the university. Well, Walker was way on the left, and I am, as you will find out tonight, very conservative. So we were polar opposites, and that night I was seated right there, and just as usual, I looked around the hall to see who would give me a cigar. And Walker said, "Here's a cigar for you, Jim," and of course it was an exploding cigar. Still remember it. When I was at the hall as an undergraduate, it was an all-male society. No girls, no women. That's right. And I went away to the United States Army and joined the Army Intelligence and served eventually after being in California and trained in German and at the Army Intelligence School in Arizona. Ended up in West Germany. And then came back afterwards and went to the law school here at UVA. And lo and behold, the society was coeducational. And that's where I met my wife, Roxanne, who is here with us tonight and is also a member of the society. And she was seated right over there. She likes to tell the story about how I showed up and sat down on the member's side next to her and asked her to go pour me a beer. And she then proceeded to tell me that she was a member of the society. So things have changed and gone on over a period. That's right. So, of course, naturally, we got married. And, the way that it's gone down. Things have changed over the years. Many of you, I'm sure, maybe all of you, remember all of our good friend Joe Bishop. Joe and I were very, very close. We met each other in the College Republicans, and he was, of course, a loyal member of the hall, and never really changed, did he? Never changed over the years, and it was my honor to speak from this lectern at his funeral services here, his memorial services that were held at the Jefferson Society. So, in short, this has always been a part of my life and Roxanne's life and the life of our family. Jay was a member of the hall. Many of you may remember my son Jay, who is now doing security, some sort of work that we don't even know what it is, up at the Pentagon. And, of course, Ashton is now president. I was never able to run for president. Well, I never able to run for president of the hall, so I'm very proud of his success. Well, listen, let's get right to it. I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about my view on where I think the country is today. And many of you will agree, and many of you will disagree, and that's all right with me. And I'll not talk entirely the entire 2 hours that I've been allotted. And then we can have a chance to do a little argument or questions and answers. I can assure you that I'll be entirely respectful to you as long as you agree completely with me. And then, and so then we will go from there. Look, I don't know what any of you all know about me, but I've devoted a good deal of my life to the state and to my country. I believe in it as a patriot. I believe in it fervently. I finished here at the undergraduate in foreign policy, went into the Army, became an Army intelligence agent, came back, went to the law school. After practicing law, was elected to be the Commonwealth's attorney for Henrico County. Then after that, I was elected to be the attorney general, then elected to be the governor. During that period of time, I had a chance to chair two national commissions, one on the internet and sales tax issues. That commission was actually set up, in my view, for the purpose of trying to put taxes on the internet. A funny thing happened on the way to the pro-tax internet commission. I was elected chairman of the commission, and the commission came back to the United States Congress and reported that we thought the internet should remain free. And it has remained free over all these years. I also chaired the National Commission on Terrorism and Homeland Security for the United States. I was approached by the Clinton administration. I understand, by the way, that John Podesta, who was the chief of staff to Bill Clinton, found out that I was named to be the chairman of the Terrorism Commission. He was just furious because a conservative Republican was put in charge of this commission. But the commission was not a political commission. The goal of the commission was to really protect the country and to protect the United States. So we started this commission in 1999, and we concluded that the country was, in fact, in great danger. In the year 2000, we wrote a plan for the United States. In the year 2001, since nobody had paid any attention, read the reports, or discussed the reports at all, we actually defined what all the elements of a national plan ought to be to protect the country, and then the attack of 9/11 occurred. Now, I was the governor of Virginia at the time. I was in the governor's mansion that morning, saw on television the first tower of the World Trade Center in flames. Roxanne and I watched the airplane, the second plane, go into the second tower of the World Trade Center. And I'd been steeped in terrorist studies for over 3 years on behalf of the United States, and now here we were in the middle of a major terrorist attack on the United States. I've chaired the Board of Visitors of the United States Air Force Academy, and I am dedicated to what I believe the future of this country is. I have felt that way when I was governor. I felt that way as a candidate for the United States Senate. And I will tell you that in my view, America is truly today at a crossroads. Now, everybody always says that. And in fact, America has been at many crossroads all throughout its history. We have seen the United States at a crossroads in many times in its history. We've seen an American Revolution that threw a foreign army off of our shores. We have seen a civil war that was fought, and this state, of course, was a major part of that, as was every part of the United States at the time. We have seen major crises and depressions, so we have seen crossroads in the past. And I was here at the university in the late 60s, and I saw the student riots that were held right outside of the hall. And right over here at Carr's Hill, when the students gathered around with torches intending to burn down Carr's Hill. But they didn't. They were actually dissuaded from that and marched right down this street and actually did set fire to the ROTC building, which at the time was Borry Hall. We've seen crossroads before in this country, and we've had many. But this today, where this country is today, in my view, goes to the fundamental question of the relationship between the citizen and the individual to his state, his government, and his country. We are redefining the country right now. And it goes to the fundamental question of that relationship. This is a real time of crisis. Now, what has been one of the catalysts? Well, this financial crisis that we've had that's going on right now. Everybody is very panicked about everything that is going on with all the finances and all the crises we've seen, the potential danger of the collapse of the banks. We have seen politicians have an interest in building up as much hysteria as possible in order to frighten people so that they'll be more willing to accept change. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing the media. Media makes money in this country by building up hysteria. And they are doing so right now and have been doing so right now. Oh, there are legitimate issues, all right. But I'm describing to you the sense of crisis that has been affecting people just over the last number of months. The business community, they're pretty happy, as a matter of fact, by a lot of the stimulus and bailout money that's going on right now, that's coming out right now. And this is a time when people are prepared to accept more change than maybe they have been in the past, and naturally we saw that in this past election, an overwhelming election in my view, as a matter of fact. We have a time right now of serious international crisis. When I was here at the university, I studied international relations, studied foreign affairs. And I remember at the time that I was in class that I was being taught back then in the 70s, early 70s, about the something that was being called at the time the revolution of rising expectations. And that meant that third world countries, people who historically had been very poor, people were exploding because they could begin to see on television, on radio, and other media a more connected world where people were expecting more and there was going to be more and more rebellion as time went on. And now what do we see? We not only see a 9/11 attack, this is one of the most unstable times in the history of the world. Right now, who knows whether we're going to see a war over Taiwan? The Japanese right now are very frightened and isolated. They have no one except the United States as an ally. Everybody here is familiar with what's going on in the Middle East and the potential upheavals that are going on there right now. Russia, which was my field of study when I was here at the university, has not gone away. Oh, they diminished all right, but the Russians are a great people, and they will not for long stand being third-class citizens of the world. And even now, you're beginning to see them more and more and more arrested. Latin America, a big opportunity right now. We could still get ahead of the challenges to come in South America and in Latin America. But we're not doing anything with that right now. And this is a time of very great turmoil. So the philosophical underpinnings, I think, are all changing right now. So let me give you several premises of this talk going forward. Number one, everything I say to you now is going to be based upon the notion of the value of the individual. The value of the individual. We are redefining right now the value of the individual in the world and especially in the United States of America. We are deciding right now what that value of that person is going to be. And I believe that the capacity of a person to get a job, to earn money, and to have that money and control over that money is, in fact, an element of freedom. It's an element of liberty. If, as we saw in Soviet Russia, you take away the capacity of people to earn for themselves and to be able to acquire things for themselves, they can't be free people. We ought to be saying today that people have the right to acquire wealth, real wealth. Well, I guess that's why all y'all are here, right? Out-of-staters? Anybody take you out-of-staters? Well, the amount of money you're paying, you got to expect to make some money at some point, don't you? I would think you would. But you may not be able to make money as time goes on in the future, and you certainly may not be able to keep it. The value of the individual and the right of persons to the fruit of their own labor and intellect is an empowerment of people. And when that's taken away, people are not free. This is a fundamental point. The connection of people's ability to earn and to gain wealth is exactly the same thing as their capacity to be free. If you don't have that capacity, you cannot be free. You will be essentially a wage slave for the rest of your life with few choices and few options and few ability to do what you want to do with your own life. And that, today, is being challenged. You know, it's funny. I think the reason I've carried this is I remember my mother, long deceased now. I remember when I was a student here, and she said, well, you know, you're studying international relations and all that junk. She said, you ought to do something where you can make some money. Have any of your parents ever said anything like that? You know, and I think it's because she'd watch my father. Yeah, I think she'd watch my father work his whole life, and he was really limited in his capacity to really do some of the things he wanted to do, and so she wanted to bear upon me the importance of this, and I didn't pay any attention to her at all. I said, "That's nonsense. Money and happiness are not connected, but money and freedom are, ladies and gentlemen. I can assure you of that." Another point that I want to make as I go forward is this. Just because George W. Bush did it wrong doesn't mean automatically that President Obama is doing it right. President Obama must be judged on his own policies. We've got to watch what he's doing, what he's thinking, and what he's saying. It is very easy to say, well, it's time for a change, and I'm going to do it this way because Bush did it the other way. And you see that right now all the time. Well, I got to tell you that I didn't agree with not only everything, but even not a lot that George W. Bush did as a conservative Republican. But that doesn't mean that Barack Obama has a free pass to remake this country without question or assessment. You have a duty to do that, as do I. And he's not alone, by the way. He's only at the top of a driving force that has been extant in this country for decades and decades and centuries, even a century. A driving left force that is trying to move the country in a particular direction. And so I would call this today the new socialism. And that is what we have here today. And, you know, it's very easy to look at these old definitions of what was going on in the 20th century. And I remember I was taught all these definitions. What's fascism? What's communism? What's socialism? And socialism, of course, was the actual capture and ownership of the rights of production by the government. And you take that to an extreme and you end up with communism, of course, and that's control not only the means of production, but, you know, everything, and all people everywhere. This is something new. Just because we have those old definitions of the past does not mean that if it doesn't fit snugly into one of those things that we can't call it for what it is. And I think this today is a new socialism. It's a new way of the control of people by limiting their capacities and their leg room to grow. That is what I think is about the business that is going on right now. And it is very dangerous to the future of this country. Let's talk about some of the elements of it so that you can see what I'm really trying to say here. Now remember, the fundamental premise is that if you can control your own money, you can be free. And if you can't control your own money, you cannot be free. Now, this is a very important point, because today, a lot of people would say that you make money for the purpose of donating to the common pot for the common good. That is not the philosophy of the individual, and it is not the philosophy of liberty. It is the philosophy of maybe well-being of the entire state and the entire community. It can be said that. And in fact, that is the driving force of the left. But it is not a philosophy of freedom. Does that mean I'm against all taxation or you should be against all taxation? Of course not. Of course not. We all give up certain elements of our freedom in order to make a contribution through taxes. We understand that. But let's remember what we're doing when we do it. When we pay those taxes, we are giving up a part of our self-insufficiency, our self-empowerment, and our freedom for the common cause. That is what we are doing. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, it is my position that people in government ought to be awfully respectful of it and very careful as you take away those kinds of assets. So let's talk about it a little bit. Take the stimulus packages, for example. We're all talking about the bailouts and the stimulus packages. Enormous amounts of money. Enormous amounts of money going out of the door. $800 billion here, $200 billion there. We're talking about trillions of dollars now, not billions of dollars. Just a few things here. The budget of the United States every year is about $3.2 trillion. About $3.2 trillion. The entire gross domestic product of the United States is about $11 billion. Closer, maybe between $11 and $12 billion, trillion dollars. So the gross product is about $12 trillion. The government of the United States' budget is $3.2 trillion. We're discussing now programs through all this stimulus and all this money flying out of the door right now are putting together a deficit of about $1.75 trillion. So on a budget of $3.2 trillion, $1.75 is going to be debt, funded by debt. Now, I suggest to you all that that is not supportable. It is not supportable. The people in the media and people in government think this money is just free. You can't understand, for example, right now why you'd ever turn down any stimulus money, right? It's free money. Doesn't cost anything. You just give it away, and off it goes. Now, it might be for a good purpose. You might make the case that it's supposed to generate more economic activity. But don't kid yourself, folks. That money is not free. That money is going to have to be financed from somewhere. And that is a living and breathing reality. You either have to borrow money, you have to tax money, you have to spend money. Those are the only three elements, moving parts of a budget. That's it. Spending, taxation, and debt. And that's all. That's all there is to budgeting. All you accounting majors, don't listen to anything else they're saying. That's all there is. Okay? And what's going on right now is that we're taxing a certain amount of money. You can't make tax enough money to pay for this spending that's going on. And so we're just putting together a debt. And now, when you get up to that kind of proportion, it is not going to be supportable. What's going to be the result? I'm here to tell you, mark it down on your pad right now and check back with me in a couple of years. We are going to have inflation. Going to have it. Got to have it. There's no other way that this kind of economic system can run this way with a giant, massive inflation. Everybody says, who cares? Who cares? If you go downtown and a CD that costs you $10 today costs you $25 in 3 years, who cares? What difference does it make? I'm here to tell you that I remember when Gerald Ford was president of the United States, and he wore a button called WIN. It was the silliest thing you've ever seen. It's called Whip Inflation Now. And the reason was because senior citizens and people of modest means could not keep up with inflation. They couldn't sustain their lives. They couldn't buy the groceries, which were doubling every 6 months. They couldn't pay for things. They couldn't buy automobiles. They couldn't support their lives. And senior citizens who were on fixed income were dying out there. And it had to be controlled. This is coming back right now, because of the policies that are being followed right now. There is, of course, a solution to it. Pay for it. You can't have this kind of debt, which will produce this kind of inflation, without paying for it eventually. And that's you guys and gals. I mean, you know, Roxanne and I, sooner or later, we'll be gone. And you'll still be paying for it. Believe me. Now, here's what they say. Don't worry about it. There's not really going to be any tax increases at all. We're going to get it out of the rich. Now, observe. Don't Americans always believe that you want an opportunity to become rich in this country? Really rich? Why would you want to do that? What, because of another Jaguar? Better ice cream? Why do you want to do that? You want to become richer because it gives you more independence so that people can't tell you what to do in life. That's why you want to get rich. And what's that called? Freedom. That is the advantage that Americans have always had, and people have come to this country through the entire history of the United States for that purpose and are still coming today to this country for that purpose, because they can live freer lives, because they can make more money. Now, they tell you right now, don't worry about it. All this money that's being thrown out of the door right now, don't worry about it, because only the rich will pay. That's what they're saying. President Obama has said, I believe that there will be no tax increases on, I think he said, 98% of the people of this country. The top 2% are going to pay for it all. Here's some facts. 2006, all the top 2% taxers in this country, taxpayers in this country, the top 2% paid $522 billion total. Total, all their taxes. Now, They say they're going to pay for all this deficit, this $1.75 trillion deficit, by increasing the taxes on the rich 5%. 5% of $522 billion is about $25 billion. $25 billion every year to pay off $1.75 trillion. It'll take 40 years. That's if you don't charge any interest on the debt. And that's if you don't increase spending anymore, like on Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security or anything else. And in fact, the projections right now is that if this kind of spending continues on over the next number of years, the deficit will be $9 trillion, not $1.75. That's just the immediate deficit. $9 trillion. At that formula for the rich, you will pay off that debt in 360 years. Not only will we be gone, you'll be gone. And your grandchildren will be gone, and your great-grandchildren will be gone. But the truth is that that's not what's going to happen. That debt will be paid. You will pay it. And that is the and furthermore, everybody you know will pay it. And that is the reality. Now, there is a way to do things better. What's the philosophy? Make people more independent. Give them the opportunity to have more self-sufficiency. Harness the engine that has always been uniquely American, if not human, just to build and create and gather wealth. That is what the solution is. They say we want to have stimulus to create jobs. No problem. Cut the corporate income tax to zero. You know what the corporate income tax produced to the United States this past year? About $425 billion. You could have cut the income tax to zero and kept all that stimulus money. What result? The world would have crowded into the United States of America to create jobs in the United States. But they didn't do that for a third of the money. Instead, they threw all this money out of the door. And that is the reality of where we are. Let's look at another thing. Let's look at global warming for a minute. The question is, where are we with global warming? It is Armageddon. It is supposed to scare the living heck out of everybody here that's in my hearing voice right now, because if we don't do something about this, we're all going to die. The creation of the maximum possible hysteria in order to make people more accepting of things that maybe otherwise they would not have been acceptance of. Like, for example, cap and trade. The philosophy of the United States of America has always been that we're entitled to conduct business in this country and to create wealth. That's what America is. But you got to be willing to submit yourself to reasonable regulation. You ought to be prepared to do that. Anti-pollution laws are fine. Proper licenses and regulations are fine. That's fine. Cap and trade's different. The ability to conduct economic activity will now belong to the government. And the government will issue you a license as to whether or not you can conduct economic activity or not. That's what, and by the way, you get to pay for that. That's called cap and trade. And then, of course, it can be traded around back and forth. But the question, the underlying question is there a debate here on global warming? Or is the debate over? Gee, you can't do all these radical changes that control people unless there is an Armageddon coming. Is it? Is it all settled? Do we know everything there is to know about this? This is the New York Times Magazine, very conservative journal, the New York Times Magazine, right? But this is from a couple of weeks ago. There's a fellow here named Freeman Dyson. He is in the Center for Advanced Studies at Princeton. Liberal, voted for Barack Obama. He says global warming's baloney. Is he right or wrong? He says that Al Gore is an opportunist, simply taking advantage of the situation right now. So my question to you is, before we go off and we give away all of our rights and give away all of our liberties and all of our ability to have economic activity, which equates to freedom, should we not settle on the science of this a little more precisely? Going forward? or is in fact in no one's interest to be able to do that. What are you going to do about energy? Conventional wisdom today is that no energy is good except green energy. Well, the truth is, I think that green energy is fine. I'm okay with windmills. I'm okay with solar power. I'm all right with all that. Hybrid cars, I think they're kind of silly, but if people want to buy them and save energy, it's okay with me. It's fine with me. Nuclear power is okay with me. That's where we're going to end up headed before this is over with. But I'm here to tell you that we'd better be prepared to go get some oil and gas right now. And we're not doing it. Why is that? Because if you reduce energy, you reduce the quality of life of people and you reduce their independence. And I'm concerned. I'm concerned. There's been a proposal for offshore drilling. It has been withdrawn in this administration. There's been a proposal, I proposed, that we get over into Alaska and get up into that area where we know there's oil and gas and begin to bring it out. Not under consideration. Utah has the capacity to produce oil and gas, off the table. Upper Midwest, the ability to produce oil and gas in the United States, off the table. When people say right now that we are too subject to foreign oil interests, they are correct and they are right. But there's two lines of thinking going on there when they say, well, we got to get off this foreign oil thing. The Greens say are thinking windmills. And the conservatives are thinking oil and gas. Do you remember just about a year ago? I remember because I was in the campaign for the United States Senate. What the price of gasoline was. It was $4.25 a gallon. And people were desperate, really desperate. $4.25 a gallon. All this talk about the Saudis and how you got to get more domestic oil supplies and so on like that. It disappeared with the financial crisis, to be sure. It is coming back. Have you noticed the gas is up about 60 cents a gallon just over the past number of weeks? It's on its way back, folks. High gas prices are on their way back because we have not done what is necessary in this moment of opportunity to produce oil and gas in this country. And that is a reality right now. How about the welfare state? Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. In 2006, they took up 8.7% of the budget. In 2050, they will take up 19%8.7% of the entire domestic product, all economic activity in this country. Those three programs are worth about 8% of that. In 2050, they will be 19% of the entire domestic economic product of this country. The historical tax rate of this country is 19%. What does that mean? Unless things change, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security will take up all the taxing capacity of the United States. Nothing else for anything else. Nothing for green energy. Nothing for defense. Nothing for anything except those three programs. Well, you say, Jim, that won't happen. What will happen? Tell me. If Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare take up all the taxing capacity of the United States, where's the money coming from? Answer. Remember, there are only three things. You're going to spend on that. There's only two other things you can do. You can borrow more money or you can tax more. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that higher taxes are on the way unless we get control of that kind of situation. And we will be like France. That's right. If you don't have budget cuts on these situations, then we will be like France. Now, there is an answer on this. It's not all bad. There is an answer on this. Do we follow a philosophy that says that in 2050 people will be totally dependent upon that money? There is an answer. And I say that answer is that we build up the capacity of people to have jobs, gain wealth, use their capacity, and create economic activity and become more independent. Do we have to completely eliminate these programs? No, and I don't think we should. But should we continue to allow them to grow to the point where they take up all the capacity and therefore more taxation is going to be imposed upon people? And remember, the more taxes that you have to give, what does that mean? It equates to freedom, because you no longer have the capacity to be independent and to be free. And that is the culture of today. The culture of today is the government programs are better if you spend more. More is better. More is better. Higher everything. Then, of course, that is the culture of today. There's only one answer. You have to create a liberated public which has the capacity to work for itself and to create that kind of assets. How about health care? I'm just going to touch on this. We're headed for nationalized health care. I don't know about you, but we've looked at the European experience, and it always means the denial of services eventually, and it always means waits for service eventually. Europe is the primary example. But you do control people if you have control over their health care. You do. How about guns? This is really more of a philosophical question, really, than it is anything else. The question is, what is the role of the individual in the state? What is it? Historically, it's also constitutionally, but never mind that annoyance at the moment. We've always had a belief and faith in the individual American citizen, that they would obey the law, that laws would be imposed against people who would break the law using firearms or sticks or clubs or knives or anything else. But we trust the people. We trust the people to have the empowerment and control over their own lives by owning a firearm. That's always what we've done. But the philosophy today would be this: deny people the instrumentality of the force. Never mind the fact that the criminals will get guns. You've heard all that before. It happens to be true, but never mind that. The question is really much more fundamental. The question is, does the individual in the community can you trust them to obey the law? And in fact, when they don't obey the law, simply prosecute them, put them in jail. Or do you remove the capacity? Kind of like a child putting up the fence so that they can't fall down the stairs, or putting in the plug to prevent the electrical outlet from being a problem. So that's really the question that we have. And finally, I can't resist talking about foreign policy for just a minute, because I love foreign policy, so I'm not sure exactly if this fits the theme, but be aware of what's going on right now and what we are doing in Iraq. In Iraq, we changed policy to a surge. And how was that to be implemented? The surge in Iraq was designed right now to say to the people over there, make common cause with the Americans. We're going to put platoons into the blocks, into your neighborhoods, and we are going to be there for you. And if Al-Qaeda comes at night to decapitate you, they will not be able to, because our people are going to be there and we're not leaving. And we'll be there next week, and we'll be there next month, and we'll be there next year. And so people began to cooperate with the Americans, and the violence began to come down, and a civil society began to emerge. What have we now told the people of Iraq? We're leaving. So that is going to undermine that policy in its entirety. But to return back to the principal theme is this. I think that we are today seeing, but I would suggest to you that the empowerment of the individual is not only the only way out, it's the best way out. The empowerment and liberation of the individual citizen to do the maximum economic activity and the maximum freedom. And I would call this the new liberty. Anytime you have a crisis, and I think we would all agree that both in foreign policy and domestically, we at least perceive there to be a real crisis. And in fact, in international relations, there is a crisis. Well, I think someone here may have studied Chinese. Someone once told me that the word in Chinese for crisis is danger and opportunity. We now do have an opportunity. And I think that we have an opportunity to come back to a new freedom. We have a new socialism now. You know what Ronald Reagan told us? Nothing is irreversible. We do have the capacity to define for ourselves what kind of society we're going to have. We do have that capacity. So I say this. Part of the new liberty ought to be that we get control of spending in this country. We get control of spending. If you don't, inevitably, it's going to be that freedom is going to be less. We have to stop these higher taxes, which you will pay inevitably based on what is going on. We have to reassess the role of wealth in this country. We have to stop doing things like throwing out the president of GM as an example to all of us, like saying that corporate people can't make but so much money according to the government. Frankly, I wish I made their money, and I don't care whether what they make. It really isn't any of my business. It's up to those businesses to control that kind of issue. And we have to enhance education. I fundamentally believe in it. You know, we define right now the McIntyre School over here as one of the great business schools in the country, but it's separated and off to one side. The truth is that all the citizenry of this country have got to become educated in finance and entrepreneurship so that they have the ability to control their own lives and do what's necessary. And I think that we have to get started on that. Now, this may require some political reform up the road, because today the political system is controlled by money, by the culture, by the media, and by the election laws. And right now there's not a lot of flexibility in our election system. But I believe that the new democracy is possible and that we can do this. Reagan said that we can do things to empower people. And I say to you, yes, we can. And this will be your job. Because one thing I've learned over my lifetime is that leaders are formed here at the Hall. When you go out of the Jefferson Society, you're going to go out in your communities, and I don't think you're going to sit around. I think you're going to work economically, and I think you're going to work politically. And you're going to be the leaders that give us an opportunity to do this. The United States has always been looked to as an example in the world. We will not be that example if we continue down this path. And working with all of you and with everyone else, as we go forward, we can create the new liberty. And that's going to make this country freer and more secure and uniquely free and secure on the earth. Thank you very much for the chance to be here with you tonight. I can't imagine everybody agrees with me, so we'll open it up for questions and answers. Madam Vice Chairman, how much time do we have? Mr. Darden, this is a ringer. I think there was a question in there somewhere, you know. I saw the report. Has everybody seen that report? Everybody's seen that report that they said that returning veterans were so potentially bitter that they were potentially subject to being recruited into right-wing extremist organizations, which are a threat to this country. Well, look, I don't think actually veterans are any more dangerous than anybody else, myself, having been in the service myself. I came back to the university, as a matter of fact, rather pleased to be here and at peace with the society. That was a crossroads because it was the 60s. This is a bigger crossroads now. And in fact, there is a great deal of an unsettled time, to be sure. I think the greater danger is conventional attack by terrorists, by foreign terrorists in this country. And I think that is a very serious problem. When we did the commission, which... has a name that's too long to pronounce. They called it the Gilmore Commission, which I was rather glad about. But we issued a report and said that there were the chances of domestic attack in this country, conventional attack by the hijacking of a plane or a train or a bomb or something of that nature, was highly probable. That was in 1999, and again repeated in 2000. And I believe that that is the potential again. I am not in favor of the overthrow of the country. Instead, I am in favor of all of you doing your jobs. And what that means is that we have to, first of all, decide what kind of country we're going to have and what kind of relationship the citizen is going to have to its government and what is in the best interest of you, your children, your grandchildren going forward in creating a free society. And then you got to go out there and make that happen. You will either be instruments of the new socialism or the new liberty. You will be. Or you'll sit around and let it happen. As Edmund Burke said, the only thing that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Well, every man and woman in this room is a good person. Now, I don't believe you'll do nothing. Some of you will adopt the new socialism, and some of you, I hope, will adopt the new liberty. And that is our best hope and chance, the leaders who are here in the Jefferson Society and others extended throughout the university. Ah, he broke the ice. I will get everybody in turn. Yes, sir. Paul, right? Okay, well, I'm actually chairman of the board of a company that deals in CDOs and CLOs, as a matter of fact. And when I was recruited to that board, I said, what is that? And what it is you take a bunch of loans, you put them together in one pot, and you sell them as one instrument, as one investment instrument. That's what it is. That's all that it is. And the trouble with this is that a lot of them were lousy loans. And so when the loans go bad, the investment's no good. The interesting thing is that companies that actually created these things, then said, well, you know, these things might not work. And so we're going to insure against them. We're going to bet against them. We're going to go to a company called AIG, and we're going to take out an insurance policy that says that if my investment goes sour, they pay me. Now, I got to tell you, I think that it's reasonable to have reasonable regulation so that we never again get in a situation where anybody's too big to fail. Because when they get too big to fail, government has a tendency to bail them out. Now, remember, folks, the government really isn't bailing anybody out. That money is not free. That is going to have to be financed, and it's going to be financed with taxation, I can assure you. And don't kid yourself with this lie that the rich are going to be able to pay for it, because they're not. The direct answer to your question, though, is that, first of all, I think government has got to not be hysterically panicked and stampeded into doing bad policy, and the bailouts were bad policy. That's the first thing. And second of all, I come back to my same point again. I think we're going to have to get the citizenry of this country more educated in what is going on with finance in this country. Otherwise, they are just sheep victims. And that is all there is to it. They're just simply people who have got to go to work, pay their taxes, so somebody else that doesn't know what they're doing can give it away improperly. And that, you can't run a country like this. Let's see, I'll come here, and then I'll come back here. Yes, sir.
Very conservative myself.
Well, I'm not sure I've got the answer to that specific question, but I'll say this. I'm thinking seriously actually about writing a book about the Republican Party. It is such a wreck. I started this talk by saying this is my view. I'm sure there are liberals in the room. Stand up and challenge and fight. That's okay with me. I mean, this is my view. And I'm trying to make the case, which I believe is right before our eyes. This is my view. I believe that the Democratic Party has become a left-wing party. I believe it is. I don't even think they apologize for it. I think that it is a left-wing party. Furthermore, I believe that it has a very consistent philosophy. Now, the Democrats fight over who's going to run it, whether it's going to be Barack or Hillary or Pelosi or Reid or whoever it's going to be, but they'll fight over personalities. But they do not fight over policy. The Democratic Party is a left-leaning party and has a very clear message. And you see it each and every day. When you go out tonight, I urge you to tune in to Keith Olbermann and you will see the philosophy. It is right there for everybody to see, and it is very consistent. And in a country that is so media-driven, it's a big help to have a consistent, clear message, particularly one that asserts that it is trying to do the right thing for the little guy. Now, I've tried to make the case tonight that the little guy is going to pay, and he's going to pay plenty. But the point is that their party is consistent. What about the Republican Party? The Republican Party is an unholy mess. We do not have a consistent message. We have a cacophony of voices in the Republican Party. It is so diverse, it has no clear message at all. It has Reagan Republicans, and I think I've tried to make that kind of case tonight. We have values conservatives who believe that abortion is the primary issue that faces the nation today, and they will speak about it relentlessly. We have moderates in our party who actually think that the Democrats' ideas aren't all that bad, and they kind of like to join up with them every now and then in order to help them. We have neocons who believe that the primary goal of the Republican Party and the policy of the United States is to go overseas and take liberty everywhere in the world in Woodrow Wilson type of foreign policy. Now, you've got at least those four groups. And none of them get along with each other all that well. So it's a real problem right now in the Republican Party. And I don't know the answer to this. I don't know the answer to this. But my hope is that a concept like the New Liberty can begin to take hold, and we can talk about the individual capacity of people and their role and their relationship to their state and to their country in a way that maximizes freedom and empowerment and capacity of people. I think that's a good message, and I think that it's the right one to counterpose against a party that believes virtually the opposite. And that's my hope, but I got to tell you, it's a problem. Now, New Englanders, I can't answer that. I think that the New Englanders have got a particular point of view and philosophy that's been around for a long period of time. But they're not opposed to electing Republicans. We've had some successes in New England over the years. But I suspect that much of the hand that I describe is going to have to play out. And once it plays out, then I think more and more people in all parts of the country will return to the philosophy if we present one. Right now, the Republican Party is not presenting a coherent philosophy, in my view. And you can't expect anybody in Boston to rally to you if you're not telling them anything intelligent. And that's, I think, where we are today as a party. I'll come here, then come back. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Governor Bill Moore, for speaking with us.
Yes.
I believe a couple weeks ago, Mr. Buchanan wrote an article calling for the abolition of the Federal Reserve System. The rationale was something to the effect that the Federal Reserve is vital to central planning in our economy. It has tremendous power over our financial system because of its power to influence the supply of money and credit. And as a result, its activities can create the sort of swings that we've seen recently. Do you see any scenario in which the Republican Party or anyone in our government is seriously considering an overhaul of our current central banking regime?
Well, I'm not in favor of the abolition of the Federal Reserve or the elimination of a central banking system. It's not unknown, by the way, in United States history. Andrew Jackson made, I think, two terms on this topic, didn't he? Destroying the Bank of the United States twice, as a matter of fact, I believe. But today, I think that there needs to be an overarching capacity to support banks so that there's not a run on banks. But what we're really seeing is Ben Bernanke. I was at a meeting with him in Washington last week, and he is very much expanding at this point the reach of the Federal Reserve. And I think that's potentially a problem. I don't think that the United States government ought to be getting into manufacturing cars. I don't think that we ought to be telling them how to, what kind of car. I don't think that we ought to be telling them that we're going to go under the hood and do a lube job. I don't think we should be doing these kinds of things. I don't think that we should be throwing out CEOs. I think that's up to boards of directors and shareholders. I mean, that's the reality of where we are. And if these companies can't make it, then they've got to go into Chapter 11 bankruptcy and rework themselves. Rework themselves. You know, I'm also on the board of a company that was, in fact, in bankruptcy. It's an airline, as a matter of fact. And I was recruited to go on the board of the emerging airline. They went into bankruptcy, but that was not Chapter 7 where you eliminate the whole company. It was Chapter 11 where you do a workout. And they worked it out. They reestablished themselves, and they're coming out, and they're very profitable today. And that's what the whole idea of the bankruptcy law is. But we didn't do that. Instead, what we took was precious cash from the taxpayer and threw it out into the community in bailouts and now stimulus programs that are interfering with the government, interfering with private enterprise, and I think slowing the capacity to bring this economy back. If the Federal Reserve intends to play that role, they should not be able to play that role. But I am not one of those Buchanan Republicans that believes that we ought to, you know, that, I mean, I've defined plenty of conspiracy tonight, but I'm not that crazy, okay? So, let's see, I was there, so let me come here and then I'll come to you. Yes, sir.
Sir, do you believe there are any times when our government should take on national debt? And if so, where would you draw the line?
Sure. As a matter of fact, as governor of Virginia, I was not opposed to debt in the Commonwealth of Virginia either. There are three things you can do, right? Spending, taxation, and debt, and that's it. And there's nothing wrong with debt as a proper instrument. Everybody borrows money to buy a house called a mortgage. Nothing wrong with that. In fact, you can put together money, and you can borrow money today at a reasonable interest rate, and you can do a project that 20 years from now would cost three times as much. Nothing fundamentally wrong with the idea of debt. The problem comes when the debt becomes so large that the public capacity of the individual citizens can no longer support it. At that point, you begin to invade the pocketbooks of your citizenry more and more and more until you begin to remove their capacity to earn and to save and to create independence. And once you do that, what are you removing from them? Freedom. That is the part that concerns me. There's nothing wrong with reasonable debt as long as it can be supported by reasonable taxation. Nothing wrong with that. But when you do this, you are setting the country up for higher taxes. Now, I'll give you another proposal. Today, about 50% of the people of the United States pay no taxes, no income taxes, about half, maybe more actually, no taxes. But they all vote. Everybody in this country votes. They get the information from the media, and that's it, unless a politician is so rich or can raise so much money that he can buy that kind of media. Other than that, you can't communicate with the public. But meanwhile, 50% of the public has no stake in our government whatsoever because they don't pay taxes. I believe every American should pay income tax, every swinging one, so that they can have a stake in the governance and the virtue, civic virtue of this country. If a person is so sick that they can't get out of bed to do anything, to make any kind of income, then they can apply for an exemption. But otherwise, every American ought to at least pay $5 in taxes. Everybody. Otherwise, how do you possibly have any accountability to the community? How do you have any stake in your government? How do you have any investment in the democracy or in the republic? How do you have any dignity, much less the ability to gain independence and wealth? This we hope for every American. And we should create a society that enables that. But at the very least, as a matter of sound governance, everybody ought to pay income tax in this country at some level. It should not be simply this business of don't worry about it, the rich will take care of it. It is a lie, and it isn't even virtuous. So this is part, I think, of the problem that we're facing today. Yes, sir, in the back.
Liberty at capitalism. Is that correct?
I beg your pardon?
You're using liberty as capitalism.
Not necessarily. I'm talking about the capacity to earn and to keep. And frankly, capitalism has been the driver of success in this country for as long as the country's existed.
Okay.
No, I do not agree with that. It's absolutely not. That is an outrageous falsehood. Outrageous falsehood. Capitalism, it depends on how you define capitalism. There's nothing wrong with reasonable regulation. I just said so. I think that when you get to the point where you allow companies to become too big to fail, you either have to let them go into Chapter 11 or they're going to end up taking the citizens your money and bailing them out, which I think is not a sustainable business model in the United States of America. But to define capitalism, you have to define it as the capacity of individuals to be able to have access to capital so that they can create businesses, secure jobs, create jobs, and have the ability to create wealth. That's capitalism. And to the maximum possible ability that you can, subject to reasonable regulation, we ought to be moving that way. The point I'm really trying to make is directional. Right? Not absolutes. I'm not dealing in absolutes here. But where are your directions? Where is the direction? We should be seeking the maximum capacity for people to earn and to save and the ability to have financial independence, not the ability to deprive them of all of that for the common pot. That is the direction in which we're going. You do this to the extent that you have to create a humane society. But no more. So that's the answer that I could give you. Let's see. I think it was you, and then I'll come to you in a minute. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that our public officials need to become more respectful with their spending of taxpayer dollars. I think respectful is a good thing. The implication seems to me that Mr. Obama's recent bailout plan was disrespectful to the American people. But can you explain to me how you can say his plan is disrespectful to the American people if they voted him into office knowing that that would be his immediate action?
Let us not forget the original bailout proposal was offered by George W. Bush. Let's remember that. But Barack Obama has taken it to a wild extreme. That's the real problem that we're facing. Remember what I tried to say at the beginning of this? Just because George Bush may have done something wrong doesn't automatically mean that Barack Obama's doing it right. That has to be assessed on its own. Now, the simple answer is, I don't think the people of the United States had a clue of what Barack Obama was going to do. I don't think they had any idea what kinds of things he was going to do. He was fresh, he was new, and he wasn't Bush. And I think that was a very powerful thing in this past election. Believe me, I was in the election. I kind of know. I was there watching it roll over me. Let's see. Who was I pointing to? We'll come to you and then back to you. Yes, sir. What country are you from?
I'm Turkish.
Good.
But if this is obviously an international problem, it's not just in the United States that we have poor people who do not have the skills vis-a-vis or to compete in the market to make a better living for themselves. How do you think, in your suggestion,
Number one, I don't believe that I would care to try to set down policy for every other country in the rest of the world. I think that Turkey, France, Britain, or any other place in the world have to decide for themselves what kind of economy they're going to run and what kind of society they're going to have. I happen to have an opinion as to what I think works best based upon provable evidence, but far be it for me to try to tell the people of Turkey how to run their country. But I do believe that within the United States of America that we have an obligation to make some decisions about how we're going to run this country. And all through the history of the United States, the capacity to come here, to create jobs, to start a business, to have access to capital, to do exciting things to create wealth, and that wealth creation is a good thing, is the essence of the American system, and therefore we have been a beacon to the rest of the world for 100 years. And I believe that we have a right to do that. Now, I also answered the question earlier. I don't believe we're doing it now. I believe that we are not educating the citizen in their responsibilities and opportunities as citizens. I believe public virtue has been down. But look, we have an opportunity here. I'm not trying to be all naysaying here. The whole concept, I didn't come to the hall tonight to talk about the new socialism and then with a frowny face walk out the back door. There is an opportunity for a new liberty here. There is. There is a chance for a new freedom. And you know what? If it's good in the United States, it'd be good in Turkey too. And that means that we have to educate people as to how to run businesses, how to work within this capitalist system, and how to make it better, and how to create independence and wealth and therefore maximize their freedom. You, sir. Well, I'm sorry, so what's your question? How do we...
With the accrual of wealth, how can we manage expectations internationally while also managing them in the U.S., and would you possibly say that expectations are managed in the United States have become too high for our accrual of wealth and our capitalist system?
I'm still not sure I get it. Did everybody else get it? Am I the only one? How are we to be an example for the world?
Basically,
I'd answer the question, but I probably ought to understand the question first. No, I don't think that American domestic policy has caused any kind of conflicts around the world. Now, I think you can make the case our foreign policy has. And I actually believe, by the way, just so that you recognize how truly flexible I am, I actually think that Barack Obama's efforts to improve the image of the United States around the world is a good thing. I like that. And I think that's an asset. But domestically, the best thing that we can do for the world is to show how a true capitalist society can in fact work. And if we do that, in fact, we've always done that. This is not really very creative, folks, actually. We've been doing this for 200 years. We have. And people around the world, I think, have looked to the United States as a beacon of what opportunity can really be in a truly free society. And that's what we ought to be promoting. If we succeed here and we show that people can gain the maximum freedom through the maximum acquisition of assets and wealth, people want that. And sooner or later, by the way, they're going to be very frustrated with democratic socialist systems that put a ceiling on people. They're not going to like that. In fact, they don't like it now. That's why they're coming here. And I think that's the best thing that we can do is to run this government and to run this society in the right way. But directionally, to move more towards ceilings on the citizenry, ceilings on their capacities, ceilings on their ability to grow and advance and to create wealth for themselves is not the right policy. And that is the new socialism that we are confronting, I think, today. Yes, sir. I'll come to you in a minute. We're working on it. You can't. If the United States tax, corporate tax rate in the United States is 35%, I believe. 35%, I believe. It is one of the highest in the world. So naturally, American companies are going to leave. Naturally. And they're going to go overseas in order to get offshore. They have to. Because we live much more in a global society today. I will tell you that I was on the board of a company was in a problem. We were competing internationally, globally, in the pharmaceutical market. And it was killing us. The corporate tax rate, blended tax rate of everything that was going on was up in the range of 42% when all was said and done, when everything was done. We were competing against companies that were overseas and other in places like Ireland paying 15. Impossible. You can't do it. So the problem is that we have got to release more of our individual capacities and jobs will come here. Now, what I said a little while ago was a bit of an exaggeration. It's right principle. I know that the government of the United States isn't going to eliminate the corporate income tax. I know that, right? I never saw a government yet that didn't want every dime they could get. I've been there. I've been governor of the state. I know, right? Legislature wants everything they can get and a lot more as well. So I know that I could do that. But if they wanted to create jobs, they reduced the corporate tax rate to, say, 10. If they reduced it to zero, it would be a no-brainer. You would give up $422 billion of revenue, and you would create an explosion of jobs here in this country and opportunities in this country to create wealth, which then people could, they would earn livings, they would have jobs, they would pay their income tax. And then the economy could grow, and you could put some of the corporate income tax back on again. But they didn't do that. Well, they never considered that. Instead, they prefer to extract as much wealth as possible from the citizenry and then throw it out of the door for their pet projects. And that's really what this stimulus is. That's really what it is. I mean, you got me as to why some of this stimulus stuff here is stimulus. I have no idea. Every day, you pick up the paper and you find that somebody's pet project is being funded by stimulus. It's not stimulus, it's government spending. That's all that's going on here. I think that we should do things to try to build up this economy, create jobs, create opportunities for people to have some future, for gosh sakes. Why are you all here? What are you doing in college? So that you can go be a wage slave all your life? You're trying to do something right now so that you can have an opportunity in the future. And that's what I think the new liberty ought to be. And that's what I'm advocating. Let's see. I think it was, yes. One more? 10:20? Okay, I'm told by the boss that I get to do one more question. Who was it that has his hand up all this time? Yes, sir. Did you get a question before?
No.
Okay, go ahead. Actually, I was just trying to annoy the members of the hall. Then I really should. Then I really should. Go ahead.
I generally tend to agree with the fact that there are a lot of scare tactics related with global warming. However, irregardless of global warming, would you say that the government needs to do more to sort of promote cleaner forms of energy than what is currently being used? And if not, why not?
No, I think that there's nothing wrong with clean energy. And there's nothing wrong with the promotion of clean energy. That's fine with me. And I think windmills are great. In fact, I might even make some money on the deal before it's over with. I might. So windmills are fine. And solar panels are fine, too. And frankly, I don't mind if somebody wants a hybrid car. If we continue to follow this policy and gasoline goes to $8 a gallon, we'll all be driving hybrid cars because they won't have any choice. That's all we'll be able to do. And in fact, some would argue that there are some people who really like it to be $8 a gallon in gas, so that you're forced to drive a hybrid car, whether you like it or not. And, maybe even the government will kind of command GM to make them, whether they like it or not, or whether people want to buy them or not. This is sort of the world we're now living in. I have no trouble with clean energy. I have no trouble with windmills, solar power, biomass, and I think we absolutely ought to do nuclear power. We just got to. We're just to the point where we just have to do it. And then hopefully you can free up some of the other fuels in order to do some of the other things like run automobiles or to run trucks. By the way, batteries won't run 18-wheeler trucks. Okay? They just won't. There's no technology in existence, probably will ever be in existence, that will run an 18-wheeler truck on a battery. Just won't happen. But one thing that we have to be doing, in my view, is this. You all will be, the people in this room, I assure you, you will be paying $4 a gallon gasoline. Soon. Real soon. Now, I'll tell you a quick story, and then I'll stop. Roxanne told me I got to stop. When I was running for the Senate, I was in Southwest Virginia. And I, usually, as usual, I pulled into a hotel about 10 o'clock at night. Young girl behind the desk clerk, young woman, single mother, second job. And I said, I'm going to be campaigning down here tomorrow all day. I want to know what the issues are down here. What's on people's minds? What do you hear people saying in the community? How about in your first job? What are people saying? People who check in the hotel, what are people saying? You go to your civic organizations and, you know, your parent-teacher association, what are people saying? And the answer was gasoline, gas prices. She said, I run a car so that I can get to and from my jobs, and it costs me, what'd she say, $40 a week, I think she said. She was working the second job to put gas in her car so she could go to her first job. And she couldn't do it. She told me that everything was going up. High gas prices were causing raises in groceries. It was causing costs of everything that she had. Costs were going up all over the place, and she was a modest employee of both two jobs, and she couldn't do it. And she said to me, that's what I want you to do. I want you to deal with this problem of gas prices. Well, gas prices have gone away as an issue. But we are not taking advantage of this moment. This is a moment in time when we could, in fact, begin to advance ourselves to getting the resources necessary. You think we ought to continue to import all this oil from the Saudis? I don't. But there's going to come a time in which we're going to want to be importing our own. You don't think we ought to be going into the Anwar Wildlife Preserve in Alaska? Well, I've studied the maps up there. One section that has the oil up there was always intended to be drilled. Always. It was set aside for that purpose. Now it's off limits. Offshore drilling. We need to be doing that. It'll create jobs, opportunity, and create some ability and capacity to do something here domestically. There are some complications to it. You know, you don't want to create all that oil and then ship it over to China, right? And that's going to require some legislation in order to control that kind of thing. But nonetheless, this is an opportunity for us right now. Well, it's been great fun. I'm glad to be home at the Hall. I wish you good luck. If there's anything I can ever do for the Hall, let me know. And Roxanne and I will be making a contribution to the treasury of this place. Thank you very much.